Oh.
Well, we're already out of control.
We
are. And today I'm going to be talking about the law and the word. And this is, I don't know if you're all aware, but this comes from early teachings of Ernest Holmes that were never really published until fairly recently. And this predates the Science of Mind textbook publishing, which was, 1927? And, you know, his teachings, one thing I like about Ernest Holmes is that you can step right into anything he's written and it seems fresh. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to really bore you guys with some definitions that I pulled from the textbook. The word, according to the textbook, is the ability of spirit to declare itself in a manifestation into form. As the word was with God, and the word was God, so the word sets the creative process into motion. And the law is defined as the mind or word in action. The creative medium of spirit is the great mental law of the universe. Both the law and the word must be understood to be used consciously. And there's no limit to the law itself, but our understanding of it may be limited. It's a blind force, so whatever we send out in our thoughts tends to return again as some condition or situation. So I started thinking about this, and what does it remind me of? Go into a fast food restaurant, and you put in your order, and there's like zero creativity. When you go into a fast food restaurant and you say, I want chicken nuggets, you get chicken nuggets, okay? You don't get them with sour cream on top or sprinkles of cheese, you get exactly what you ordered. And that's how the law works. You get exactly what you order in the energy that you put into something. So if you go into a restaurant and ask for some chicken nuggets and fries, that's what you get. And that's the same way as the law itself works. So I'm sorry, I'm out of control already.
No, never apologize. I'm enjoying this. Keep going.
Okay, so everything we touch, this phone, everything is what we call an effect or matter. So these are controlled by what we call the law, and that's set into motion by our creative thought. So from the last chapter in this book, we learned that we all have our being in an infinite mind, which presses against us on all sides. And immediately my mind brought to forth the image of wrapping myself in saran wrap. But, you know, that's kind of like infinite mind. If I was wrapped around there, that'd be the infinite mind. And it means that we need to stop looking outside ourselves. And no person or thing or place, and realize that whatever truth we have comes from within us, not from outside of us. So I started thinking about batteries and flashlights. I'm sorry. I'm having too much fun with this.
Move it. That's the point.
Bouncing back and forth.
So if you have a flashlight and you put the correct size battery into it and your bulb is actually working, your result is light. So it requires a certain amount of charge, having a switch that works and a functioning light bulb. And so using our creative power is kind of like using a flashlight. And if you have a weak battery, you get a weak light. And so I started thinking about how that relates to the fact that we just passed the solar new year a little over a week ago, and everything feels fresh and new to us, like a new set of batteries and a new light bulb. And it's the perfect time to start thinking about our part in the creative process. So I don't know about you guys, but thinking about springtime makes me think about newness. The new year, I mean, it, you know, in January 1st is a nice time to start thinking, but when you actually start seeing flowers on the trees and you start thinking about planting your gardens, you're really thinking about the creative process. So Holmes said that in the previous chapter that we get together to discuss the same principle over and over and over again. And what this does, instead of, it shouldn't bore us so much as what we do is every time we dig into this subject, we go a little deeper. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I know Connie likes to talk, and probably you too, Mary Rose, is that every time we dig into a subject, we start getting new insights. So now I've forever got the image of a flashlight when I think about the love and the law. So this concept of the power within us started, as far as I know, started gathering momentum in the last century from the East. Because this is a pretty Christian, you know, pretty fundamentalist Christian country in many ways. And the reason I say that is I've been doing a lot of work transcribing a journal from my great-great-grandfather. And for him, it was all about the people that he brought to Christ. And this is a Congregationalist church, you know. So, you know, I mean, this is a Christian, a Christian nation, at least the way it was founded. So, but then, thank God, you started getting, you know, thought from the East. Vipassana? How do you pronounce it?
Vipassana, correct.
Vipassana. Or insight meditation came, was brought to the D.C. area in 1965 when they established the first monastic community. Zen Buddhism and other forms of Buddhist thought, including the Dalai Lama's teaching, came to this country both through immigration and teachers that would come to visit. And then it began to be adopted by Americans. So then there are those of us who were in our teens in the 60s, and we were probably influenced by these teachings. And we didn't think of these as strange at all, but we embraced them. It was like, and my grandmother told me many times that the spirit of that particular age in this country was a reflection of the reincarnation of all these souls that had come back from the First World War and were looking to be expansive. Yes, my grandmother was an incredible person.
That's awesome.
Yes.
Did you repeat that? The 60s were the...
In the 60s, yeah, and some of the Vietnam War protests and the influx of Eastern thought was due to the reincarnation of soldiers from the First World War. And I've just seen a movie, it was a documentary on the First World War, and I can believe it. Mm. I can believe it. Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that influences us as teenagers, it seems, is music. And so on this date back in 1920, there was a sitar virtuoso who's known throughout the world. His name was Ravi Shankar, and he was born in 1920. And he introduced many of us Westerners to Indian classical music. And he was associated with a great violinist, Yehudi Menuhin. Mm-hmm. Menuhin, and also George Harrison, mm-hmm. who was one of my favorite musicians from back in my teen years. So there was this a well-known music critic in the Washington Post, Paul Hume, who wrote, "As for Shankar and the sitar, they are extensions one of the other, each seeming to enter into one's soul in one of the world's supreme musical arts. Mm-hmm. It's a thing inimitable, beyond words, and forever new. For, as Shankar explained, 90% of all the music played was improvised, so it was coming from within." Mm-hmm. So then I remember a very fine musician named David Gordon, who once told me that there's only one song. And you keep playing that one song over and over again, but to me it always sounds different. It's different. And so, you know, these are two examples of the extraordinary use of creative power. What do you think, John?
Well, you know, the improvisation part is very much like jazz. In Western jazz, we have a lot of improvisation with certain ground rules. And in Hindustani music, ground rules also, mm-hmm. and improvisation. And I think to be a developed musician, now I might get an argument about this, but one needs to be schooled or study
right.
and be literate and also know how to invent on the spot. Like we're doing now, I'm improvising right now in my speech, just mm-hmm. making it up, putting it together as I go along. But to do it musically or in your respective arts, that's part of the development. So yeah, the improvisation is big. I teach that when in my independent music studio too. We learn to read, we learn to repertory, but we also learn how to improvise musically.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you influenced at all by the music that came through with the musicians when you were a teenager?
Yes, I was. Thanks for asking. Well, you know, the resonance with me, the sympathetic vibration of thought was the big influence for me. I was on a gymnastics team, and we were having a Christmas party. And I wasn't into music at that time. I had had some accordion lessons, and that influenced me, so I knew about reading music. Well, at this party, there was a guy who was playing the flamenco guitar. He was on the gymnastics team. Mm. And that, wow, my goodness, you know, my mother's family is from Mexico and Texas. And I said, wow, I've got to learn some of this. This, it was fiery, it was nice, it was a portable instrument, you can take it anywhere. So from there, I went home and I looked up in the family encyclopedia, guitar. I saw the way it was tuned. I read the whole article. I made a diagram of all the notes of the fingerboard of the guitar. And I haven't put it down since. I brought it today. I don't know if I'll play it. It depends on how it goes. But the point being, yes, in my teens, I was on fire with the guitar as I saw it played. And so that was a vibration. There was a set of chords inside me that said, come. I think so. For some people, music finds us. We don't find music. You have a calling, as so many other people have, not only in music and spirituality, but yes, teens. Thank you.
Yes. You know, when I was a teenager, as many of you know, I was a cellist for many years, mm-hmm. and they had a talent show in my high school, and one of my cellist friends and I hooked our cellos up to amplifiers for the talent show and played Within You, Without You, which is one of the most famous Beatles songs that have, you know, reflects that Eastern influence. And that song still resonates within me.
You're so lucky. You were blessed too.
I was.
Can I say something real quick? Real quick. And with my consciousness of music, I can take one note, just one note, doesn't matter. Any note. That becomes the subject. There's everything in that one note. And all the other notes are just accomplices. They're just accomplices.
Okay.
But it all is in that one note.
So, getting back to the subject today, yes. which is the subject David just talked about and John talked about, which is the law. Everything we touch or see is called an effect. And the thing that blew my mind was when Holmes said, even our planet is an effect. Mm-hmm. Now, we didn't. You and I probably didn't create it, but it was created. And, you know, it's controlled by the law. There's a solar system, the sun, and all the stars up in the heavens are an effect. And that's what, I mean, it took the concept of an effect way past what I normally think of, like I think of this room, this group, as an effect of a lot of intentions. But at some point there was some intention out there that created the earth and all the planets and all the people and the seas and everything on it in back of it. And the word or cause was with God, as Holmes says, and the word was God, and the word still is God. Our word, our thought, is the activity of the one mind in our own consciousness. And the thing that holds the planet in its place, the thing that causes your blood to circulate and your food to digest, the things that causes your business to succeed, the thing that makes the tide come in and go out, and the thing that holds the planets in space, it's all the same thing. And I kept thinking about that, and I was thinking, oh my God. You know, you think about how large corporations are run. That's nothing compared to, you know, managing to keep everything in place and, you know, the tides and the blood flowing in our bodies. So everything has its own separate law, which is created for the purpose of doing one special thing. Like, there's a law that created daffodils. There's a law that you know, keeps hearts beating, and another one for things like composing music. And I'm still toying with that idea. I haven't totally digested that. That there are specific laws for everything. And I thought there was only one law. And it was kind of one of those things where once you had the thought and you put it out there, the law just went to work on it. But I'm still learning. Yes.
Could it be that, like, the law of cause and effect is like the single overview, and then all these other laws kind of come under that for each individual thing? Sort of like a flowchart, you know?
Exactly. It could be. Let me chew on that for a while. So, I have an extreme example for you that if your word says that there's no longer any life in your body, it'll start to withdraw itself and the body will start to disintegrate. And this is an example from the book. And I have also read that among the Tibetan monks, when they reach a point where they know their life is over, they sit down, they meditate, and they withdraw their consciousness, and they expire. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's just an incredible example of, you know, of using the word for, it's not destructive because we all go at some point.
There's a great story about Buckminster Fuller doing exactly that.
Really?
Yep. His wife was afraid to die, and so he promised her that he would go before her. And she was very ill, and she was in California and he was in New York. And he got a phone call that said, "You're going to go first. You need to come home now." And he caught a plane, and he arrived there. He connected with his wife, and it was nighttime, and he sat down in the chair next to her. And before morning, he died. And then she died the next day.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
Yes.
Wow. Then he wasn't the sick one.
No, she was the sick one. He made the choice to die. He was in control of that. I think that's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. That is, yes.
He knew that she was going to die.
Yeah.
Right.
So he just
and he kept his bones.
So as I was reading through this chapter, I was looking for other examples that would help amplify my understanding of it. And I've been reading through a book called Be the Pack Leader, written by Cesar Millan, the dog whisperer. And the book is about training dogs and dog owners. And his theory is that we're the creator of the problems our dogs have. So he said that in Eastern religions have long been champions of the idea that we create our own reality, and what goes on in our minds becomes manifested in our lives. So that we humans, with our powerful consciousness, can do something which dogs cannot. We have the ability to create our reality. And he's saying that dogs don't. I'm not sure I agree with that, but... And we are able to create the energy that we project to our animals. So one of Milan's training tactics is to work with dog owners on this very issue, the energy that they project. And he was a student of Wayne Dyer. And he said to achieve a calm and assertive state of mind, which is what we need to be able to, you know, function with our dogs and not have them act out, our minds and intentions, our emotions and intentions have to line up in harmony. So if I go out and I'm acting tough, like I'm in charge, and I feel terrified instead, my dog will know instantly. Yeah. And I remember a story that my grandfather told me of a person walking down the street who was just terrified of dogs. And there was a big wall in front of a house. And as he was walking by, a dog on the other side jumped over the fence and bit him.
Wow.
But the dog could sense that energy coming from him. So it's a good reminder that we create the energy that we're projecting with our dogs, and so we can change the way we're putting that energy out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good for Stephen and me, dealing with a rescue dog. And part of the secret for ramping up the effect you create is to dream on a large scale. So I was thinking, well, I think I'd like to go to Europe maybe and take a cruise in the Greek islands, because my friend Connie went recently and it sounded like so much fun. So I'm thinking I might end up on a private yacht with some friends,
whoa,
metaphysical friends. We might learn some Greek, you know, enough to get around in the islands, and we'd have an incredible chef. It would be a blast. Or if I start thinking I really don't deserve a good time, but I'm going to go to Greece anyhow, I might end up on a second-class boat that breaks down in the middle of the ocean, you know, that sort of thing. So I realize I've got to think big, and we all need to think big. And we can muddy our energy up by reminding ourselves we don't deserve to have fun, to be healthy, to live an abundant life. And so the more we do plunge into a conscious union with the infinite mind, the greater our power. So mixing negative and positive thoughts, as Holmes puts it, will muddy up the energy and doesn't put you into a stream of affirmative consciousness. So lastly, just remember to be calm and knowing that all is well, that struggle is self-defeating, and that we must live in joy, peace, and happiness. And so it is.
So it is.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thank you.